Now, shall we begin?
Elected officials from inside Colorado trying to strike down legalized marijuana in court. A group of six Colorado sheriffs kicked off their lawsuit at the press club in Washington, D.C.
They need direction from the courts which oath of office they are to uphold.
Larimer County Sheriff Justin Smith, the lead plaintiff, says he's torn between his oath to uphold the U.S. and Colorado constitutions because state and federal laws don't agree on pot. He's joined by counterparts in Kansas and Nebraska who say Colorado pot isn't staying in Colorado, and it's costing them more to crack down on it.
They're law enforcers. They're not lawmakers.
One of the fathers of Amendment 64, Mason Tvert, called on the sheriffs from Colorado to resign. Today, Tvert and the sheriff in studio to hash out their arguments over legal marijuana.
When the United States emerged from the nearly 13-year collective frenzy of puritanical absurdity called prohibition, the consumption of alcohol was legalized in two phases. The first was to allow people to purchase, to sell, and to deliver actual beer. And then a few months later, in December of 1933, the last remaining prohibitions against the sale and consumption of hard liquor were repealed. The evening of December 5th, 1933, marking the return of the legal consumption of hard liquor, began as a carnival but soon degenerated into frustration, notes Edward Beer in his book Prohibition, 13 Years That Changed America. Owing to the Depression, many of the former speakeasies had closed, and some had not yet obtained their legal licenses. In a sudden excess of legalism, they were unwilling to risk penalties by serving hard liquor without a permit. All over America, wines and reputable hard liquor were in short supply, and those establishments that had obtained stocks soon ran out of whiskey, gin, and champagne. New Jersey Governor Harry Moore solved the problem by announcing that, quote, liquor has been sold illegally in this state for 13 years, and it will probably not hurt if this is done a few days more. Even on the night of December 5th, 1933, continues Mr. Bear, reporters noted that there was very little actual drunkenness on the streets. Even if shortage of supplies and of cash were partially responsible, America appeared to have come of age. The major bootleggers rapidly completed their reconversion into the legitimate liquor business. Joe Kennedy Sr., father of JFK, became the official distributor of Haig and Haig and Pinch Bottle Whiskey and Gordon's Gin even before Prohibition's repeal. Samuel Bronfman, Canada's biggest bootlegger and Lucky Luciano's biggest supplier, founded Seagram's. Frank Costello and his underworld partners set up Alliance Distributors, selling the same brands of Scotch, King's Ransom, House of Lords whiskey, they had smuggled into the United States during Prohibition. They also acquired a controlling interest in J. Turnley & Sons, another Scotch distributor. Meyer Lansky, with Luciano, Bugsy Siegel, and others, set up the Capital Wine and Spirits firm and became leading importers of vintage French wines, Scotch, and Canadian whiskey, even in jail. And after he was deported to Italy in 1946, Luciano continued to receive a large share of the profits. As students of organized crime well know, racketeers simply found new targets. After December 1933, New York's underworld bosses began extending their protection activities to bakeries, restaurants, laundries, limousine services, the garment industry, and New York's Fulton Fish Market. Today, underworld bosses in New York's Chinatown display a businesslike ruthlessness that Al Capone could well have envied. More ominously, from time to time, evidence surfaces of a form of gangland police collusion, at least in Chinatown, that was so prevalent during Prohibition. One of the most consistent critics of the Prohibition era had been H.L. Mencken. What infuriated him most was the mediocrity of all those concerned with Prohibition. William Jennings Bryan had been a charlatan, a mountebank, a zany without any sense of dignity, Harding a numbskull, Coolidge a dreadful little cad, and Hoover a pious old woman, a fat Coolidge. Mencken's distrust of all those involved in good works was total. To him, any reformer was a prehensile Methodist parson, bawling for prohibition and its easy jobs. On its repeal, he wrote, "Prohibition went into effect on January 16, 1920, and blew up at last on December 5, 1933, an elapsed time of 12 years, 10 months, and 19 days. It seemed almost a geologic epoch while it was going on, and the human suffering that it entailed must have been a fair match for that of the Black Death or the 30 Years' War." To this, Mr. Bear comments, was the Prohibition balance sheet that overwhelmingly negative? The answer must be yes. Mencken may have deliberately exaggerated the number of dead and physically maimed, but in all sorts of ways, there was a fatal impact. Walter Lippmann, the famous liberal columnist and critic whose career began during the Prohibition years, denounced the circle of impotence in which we outlaw intolerantly the satisfaction of certain persistent human desires, and then tolerate what we have prohibited. His remarks could well apply to certain current byproducts of political correctness. Like ex-President Taft, Lippmann also pointed out the dangerous consequences of attempting to stamp out later tolerated vices, thereby turning over their exploitation to the underworld. For Prohibition was not the end of organized crime in America, but only its beginning. For all his caricatural exaggeration, Mencken was right when he first spotted this tendency. Writing while Prohibition was still in force, he noted that it no longer astonished anyone when policemen were taken in evildoing. If before that time the corps of Prohibition enforcement officers, that is, a corps of undisguised scoundrels with badges, had been launched against the populace, there would have been a great roar of wrath and much anguished gnashing of teeth. People would have felt themselves put upon, injured, insulted. But, with the old assumption about policemen removed from their minds, they met the new onslaught calmly and even smilingly. Today, no one is indignant over the fact that the extortion of these new policiers increased the cost of potable alcohol. What had happened during Prohibition is that the market took over entirely the provision of the substances used by people to obtain these illicit satisfactions. The market factored into the price of various forms of alcohol a risk premium, because those who produced it and distributed it confronted the likelihood of being pursued by the police and perhaps being imprisoned. But the market functioned very well. It was a black market. You can make a good case that all free markets are black markets. Once Prohibition was repealed and alcohol became regulated by the state, the corruption that was attendant to Prohibition found new expression, both in terms of the criminal underworld and the political overworld. That happened with alcohol a century ago. It's going to happen with marijuana today. Marijuana prohibition is dying, but before it is finally and blessedly abolished, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of lives will be ruined by people within the enforcement apparatus seeking to extract that last quantum of profitable misery. People of a criminal bent who had been involved in helping to supply the market for marijuana are going to find different avenues to express their evil intentions. And the same will be true of their much more dangerous counterparts in what we might call the criminal overworld, that is to say, law enforcement and the political realm. That's what happened a century ago with alcohol prohibition, and it is happening now in the last days of marijuana prohibition, and as the effort to decriminalize the consumption of all these substances that have been legal in the 19th century continues. And just as it is true that gangsters and racketeers will find new targets, prohibitionists will find new human weaknesses and appetites to render illicit. I'll have a great deal more to say about the subject when I return. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Stand by for more sedition after this.
So when this news conference came out, I heard kind of both sides call into question the motives of the other side. I heard some talk at the press conference from you about how the campaign may not have been forthright with everything when they were trying to advance Amendment 64 from your perspective. I heard you saying that you thought this was the arrest and prosecution industry, that they just want to arrest folks. Do you honestly not believe that the guy sitting across the table from you actually has the best interest of Colorado at heart?
Well, he very well probably does, but the fact is that marijuana is an objectively less harmful substance than alcohol. A strong majority of Coloradans don't think adults should be arrested simply for using it. And, you know, I don't think our law enforcement officials should be fighting against voters and elected officials to keep arresting and prosecuting adults who are really not engaging in a behavior that is any really different than alcohol other than being less harmful.
The greatest concern that I have, and I think my colleagues have and our plaintiffs have, is the exposure of youth to this drug, because it's just not controlled. It's poisoning our young people.
My name is Annette Shattuck, and I'm here today because my family and I are victims of civil asset forfeiture, and my husband and I have four children, 9, 7, 4, and 4, including one adopted son with special needs. We were raided on July 28, 2014, and in those raids, the Drug Task Force of St. Clair County executed a no-knock search warrant on my home where my four children were with my mother, who's 56 years old, who was clipping coupons at the time. After they breached my door, they, at gunpoint with masks, they proceeded to take every belonging in my house. And when I say every belonging, I mean every belonging. They arrested my mother and confiscated her phone and such, which was not returned after she was not charged criminally. They never returned her phone. And they subsequently hung my lingerie from my ceiling fans, left feces in my toilet, took every box of food and cereal from my pantry, emptied them in a pile, and crushed them. My children's artwork was on the floor with boot prints on it.
The two oldest members of the U.S. Senate convened a four-witness hearing Tuesday to discuss concerns about marijuana legalization, but chose not to invite anyone supportive of the policy or with direct experience administering recreational pot laws in Western states, according to U.S. News and World Report. Drug reform advocates denounced the hearing as a poorly informed waste of time, and senators most supportive of reforming federal marijuana laws did not attend. Senators Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, and Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat of California, called the hearing of the Caucus on International Narcotics Control last month after a Government Accountability Office report said that the Justice Department wasn't documenting its monitoring of enforcement guidelines laid out by the Obama administration in 2013. The guidelines were contained in a memo allowing for the first state-regulated recreational pot markets in Colorado and Washington, despite marijuana possession remaining a federal crime. There are 8 enforcement triggers in the guidelines that could prompt federal intervention, including the distribution of marijuana to minors, negative health consequences, or the smuggling of marijuana across state lines. Opponents of marijuana legalization believe a closer look at Colorado and Washington could reveal that federal intervention is warranted, and the Justice Department, should it seek to shut down state-regulated pot markets, likely would have a better case than neighboring states, anti-pot sheriffs, and anti-drug groups, all of whom have lost in court. And they have lost in court because it is assumed that when a state legalizes marijuana for recreational or medical use, sheriffs who oppose that policy and who seek to enforce federal laws are behaving as private actors, not as government officials. But supporters of marijuana legalization say the sky hasn't fallen and were enraged that Grassley and Feinstein, each 82 years old and leaders of what's informally called the Drug Caucus, opted not to include anyone on their panel who would say so. At this point, there's not really a public interest rationale for these efforts to prolong the misery of prohibition. These are people who simply have a vested interest, I contend, in maximizing human suffering, of the sort that we could read about in this article from the March 30th Washington Post. A self-described Michigan soccer mom who had every belonging taken from her family in a 2014 drug raid, has been cleared of all criminal charges 19 months after heavily armed drug task force members ransacked her home and her business. But in many ways, her ordeal is just beginning. Annette Shattuck and her husband Dale had been facing felony charges of possession of marijuana with intent to distribute, possession with intent to manufacture marijuana, and maintaining a drug house. But last month, Michigan Circuit Court Judge Daniel Kelly threw out all criminal complaints filed against the Shattucks on the grounds of entrapment by estoppel. The phrase entrapment by estoppel refers to the fact that they had been told that what they were doing was legal, and yet the local sheriff's office tried to prosecute them for offenses against federal drug laws. The Shattucks case is an illustration of how the nation's patchwork marijuana laws can be a confusing mess for patients, businesses, and law enforcement officials alike. Nearly two dozen states now have medical marijuana laws on the books, but laws vary significantly from state to state, and even within states, various arms of government have clashed over how the laws are interpreted and enforced. In 2014, the Shattucks were starting up a marijuana dispensary under Michigan's medical marijuana law. They worked to ensure every last detail was in full compliance with the laws as they understood it. They obtained the permission of the landlord of the building where the dispensary, called the DNA Wellness Center, was to be housed. They went to the local planning commission meetings to obtain the proper permits and licenses. They discussed business hours, security measures, and even signage requirements with the planning commission. The town building inspector checked the property and approved the signage. The chairman of the planning commission publicly thanked the Shattucks for working within the allowed legal framework. According to court documents, the Shattucks even went so far as to call the local sheriff's drug task force to invite them to inspect the property and verify their compliance with the law. "We really went above and beyond," Annette Shattuck said in an interview. "We asked for help. We went out of our way to make sure that everything was legit." This is precisely what Bill Isbenson and Raymond Kangas did in Ontario, Oregon, when they set up the 45th Parallel Medical Marijuana Co-op about 4 years ago. They called the Ontario Police, they called the Mount Hair County Sheriff's Department, they called the Chamber of Commerce, they contacted everybody, they were completely above board in all their dealings with their business partners and with the regulatory elite in Ontario and in Mount Hair County. To continue now with the Washington Post story, but the task force never inspected the property. Instead, acting on an anonymous tip that marijuana was being sold at the location, agents of the St. Clair County Drug Task Force conducted a number of controlled buys where informants with medical marijuana cards entered the dispensary and purchased marijuana under the guise of medical use. That gave them enough probable cause to execute a raid. And damn it, that's exactly what happened with the 45th Parallel, except in that case, a really despicable little specimen named Justin Bloxham, who is a hyper-ambitious and bloody-handed DEA agent in Boise, decided that he wanted to conduct an operation targeting this dispensary in another state, in a city across the state line from Idaho, where medical marijuana was legal. And so he contacted Brad Williams, an equally reprehensible deputy in the Mount Hair County Sheriff's Office, and the two of them put together a plan where Dustin Bloxham, after suborning a doctor into falsifying a medical record and creating a false identification card, illegally obtained a medical marijuana card in Oregon so that he could go to this clinic and receive medical marijuana. That's precisely the same routine that was used against this couple in Michigan. And in the state of Oregon, similar consequences ensued. There was a multi-site raid on September 11th of 2012 and a huge prosecution that ended up siphoning away hundreds of thousands of dollars in confiscated assets and otherwise inflicting ruin on the lives of people who had done no harm. As Benson and Kangas were prosecuted under a dead letter statute, because before the prosecution began, subsequent to the raids, but before the court trial began, the law in Oregon was changed. And yet, in spite of the fact that that law was a dead letter, they were still prosecuted under the Oregon equivalent of the RICO Act on the assumption that their legitimate and benign enterprise was a criminal syndicate. Neither of them ended up spending time in prison, But Billis Benson saw literally hundreds of thousands of dollars stolen from him through asset forfeiture. That money was illegally used to prosecute him. And several of his businesses, not merely the marijuana dispensary, but several of his businesses were destroyed, and he lost many of his commercial properties, and he almost lost his home. And this was all done, once again, because a federal agent, colluding with a corrupt local sheriff's deputy, decided to exploit ambiguities in the law in order to prosecute somebody for an activity that they had been told was entirely legal. One has to ask, who will be the last person to see his life ruined needlessly in the name of drug prohibition? I'll be back in just a minute.
Good afternoon. On behalf of all elected county sheriffs that you see standing around me, I want to thank you for attending this briefing today. I'm Justin Smith, the sheriff of Larimer County. We are here to provide a voice to the millions of honest, law-abiding Coloradans who were ignored by their governor, as well as by the majority party in their state house. We watched as the president, New York billionaire Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and the leaders of his party, as they're now throwing their political clout behind continued efforts to pose yet more and more gun control laws on Colorado. While these dedicated county sheriffs stand here publicly for the rights of their citizens, the president, later today, will be hiding behind the walls at the Denver Police Academy, surrounding himself with hand-picked audience of gun control supporters and police employees coerced to his political rally as he declares victory for the Denver Governor John Hickenlooper. We are here to remind you that the voices of the 62 elected Colorado sheriffs were silenced by the leaders of the majority party in the state house. Your governor found it too inconvenient to even allot 15 minutes to hear the concerns of the sheriffs of his state. One should logically ask why. Why was it too inconvenient to listen to an opposing viewpoint? The answer lies in the agenda-driven politics. Gun control advocates were keenly aware that they had a short window of opportunity to exploit the emotions surrounding these tragedies in Newtown and Aurora. Polling showed them that citizens were too desperate and they wanted to do something, do anything, and in the words of Rahm Emanuel, they did not want to waste a crisis. The president and Mayor Bloomberg watched the polls. They now realize that the emotional response that they were counting on to pass their agenda has made a turn. Just this week, CBS News released poll results that showed that fewer and fewer Americans support additional gun control laws, and that continues to trend downwards. The president and Mayor Bloomberg are desperate. They have watched their window of opportunity close. You see, a thinking, reasoned citizenry is much harder to fool.
Where laws are ambiguous or even contradictory, law enforcers can be relied upon to resolve those ambiguities in favor of coercion and prosecution rather than individual liberty. This is exemplified by Justin Smith, the sheriff of Colorado's Larimer County. Over the last 3 years, he has been involved in two lawsuits against the governor of Colorado, John Hickenlooper, dealing with two issues in which federal and state laws might be in conflict. The first involved firearms possession. The second involved marijuana use. With respect to the right to keep and bear arms, Sheriff Smith has argued in favor of interposition against federal law. With respect to marijuana consumption, he has argued for interposition in reverse, which is to say for federal supremacy, insisting that he had a duty as a Colorado sheriff as the sheriff of Larimer County to enforce federal law against constituents who had voted to repeal these unconstitutional federal edicts. In 2013, acting out of concern that the Obama administration would impose new restrictions on firearms ownership, Sheriff Smith published an essay on his Facebook page entitled Preserving Our Constitutional Republic. I will read a few excerpts from that essay. The United States was very deliberatively, his word, established as a constitutional republic. John Adams said it succinctly, we are a nation of laws, not a nation of men. Our founding was based on the clear understanding that we are endowed by our Creator with our unalienable rights. While our Constitution clearly defined these rights, it did not create or establish these rights, and no government official has the authority to take these rights away. Sheriff Smith apparently doesn't understand that the right to consume anything of your choosing is among those unenumerated rights. If you own yourself, you have the right to decide what it is that you are going to consume. The only way that you can contend otherwise, that you could argue that a government has the right to punish you for something you choose to consume, is if you assume that the government owns you and you have no unalienable rights. To continue, our founders had the wisdom to establish a nation where citizens granted the authority to be governed from the local level up to the federal level, and they made it clear that the powers of the federal government were to be limited to only those areas defined in our Constitution. This, of course, is a sound principle from a constitutional perspective, and it is directly at odds with what Sheriff Smith did on the issue of marijuana. 54% of the electorate in his county voted on behalf of Amendment 64, which is to say the provision that decriminalized the use of marijuana in the state of Colorado for adults. 54% of the electorate, the people who elected him as sheriff. That's the local mandate. Under the reasoning he expressed in this relatively lucid essay, Smith would have to concede that the local mandate overrules what the federal government had ordained, especially in light of the fact that there is no provision of the Constitution authorizing the federal government to prohibit the consumption of alcohol or marijuana or any other substance. A century ago, when prohibitionist Pharisees wanted to criminalize the use of alcohol in this country, they had to change the Constitution. No similar change has been made to the Constitution with respect to marijuana or cocaine or heroin or any other substance. Colorado was established with the constitutional office of the sheriff. Smith continued, statutes define the specific duties of the sheriff, but through tradition and law it is clear the sheriff's duties include the absolute obligation to protect the rights of the citizens of the county, and the sheriff is accountable directly to those citizens. Once again, that's a very good summation of the history and duties and responsibilities of the sheriff. Why was he doing precisely the opposite with respect to the right of Colorado residents in Larimer County to use marijuana? Why wasn't he interposing on their behalf against the federal government as it sought to violate those rights through unconstitutional marijuana laws? As sheriff, pledged Smith, I will not enforce unconstitutional federal laws. You are a liar, sir. Not only are you willing to enforce unconstitutional laws against the consumption of marijuana, you were willing to file suit against the state government in order to establish the supposed supremacy of the federal government. In the March 5th, 2015 issue of Colorado's Westword magazine, it is noted that Smith was among a group of sheriffs in Colorado who had filed suit against the governor of Colorado with respect to state gun laws that he considered to be unconstitutional. The gun law effort failed in June 2014 when a judge determined that rules banning magazines that held more than 15 rounds, among other challenged regulations, were constitutional. But that hasn't stopped Smith and 11 other plaintiffs from suing Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper on constitutional grounds when it comes to Amendment 64, a measure passed by Colorado voters in 2012. That legalized limited marijuana sales for recreational purposes. Amendment 64 pursues only one goal, legalization of marijuana, a goal which is diametrically opposed to the many objectives which Congress has established and repeatedly reestablished for the United States Anti-Drug Policy and Practice for Marijuana as a Controlled Substance, asserted the lawsuit. If allowed to continue in effect, Amendment 64's legalization and commercialization scheme will conflict with and undermine the federal government's careful balance of anti-drug enforcement priorities and objectives. It will permit and enable at least hundreds, if not many thousands, of marijuana cultivation, distribution, sales, and consumption operations. It will permit and enable vast quantities of marijuana with a commercial value of billions of dollars to be placed into commerce. It will directly conflict with express federal policy, which prohibits entirely the possession and use for any purpose of certain controlled substances, including marijuana products. Finally, this is the part of the lawsuit that I find most arresting, if you will. Finally, it will interfere with vital foreign policy interests by disrupting the United States' relationship with other countries which have entered into treaties and protocols with the United States to control trafficking in marijuana and other controlled substances. When it comes to the issue of the sovereign and indefeasible right of an individual to consume marijuana, that is a right. That is an unenumerated right. It is a function and a dimension of self-ownership. Justin Smith and his comrades are federal supremacists. What that tells me is that they're posturing as champions of the right to individual self-defense is utterly false and cynical. You cannot selectively be a federal supremacist. You cannot say that in some circumstances I will interpose against the feds and in other circumstances I will be their servile tool. It's just a question of at what point you will become uniformly a servile tool. I'll be back in a minute.
You would legalize marijuana, cocaine, heroin?
I would get the government out of regulating all those substances, and I would allow the states to deal with problems, whether children should have them, whether children can buy cigarettes and alcohol or hard drugs, marijuana, and different states would probably do different things. The first federal law against marijuana was 1938, and they did it through high taxation because they knew they didn't have authority to say that you're not allowed to smoke marijuana. Today, it's gone berserk. The federal government comes in and overrules a state that has legalized marijuana to be used for very sick people, AIDS and cancer, and they're getting some help. The federal government comes in, puts people in prison that are sick because they're using it for medical reasons, and they've never committed a violent crime. That's how absurd the war on drugs has become.
Alcohol prohibition led to more crime. You argue that even heroin could be legal if some state decided, wouldn't?
I think under our system of government that would be the case. But if you ask the people who are against it, if a state did that, would you use it? They say, oh no, I wouldn't use it. It's always those other people that might use it, so I have to take care of them and prevent them from doing harm to themselves.
What about that? Is that a role for government?
No, I don't believe so. I think the government's role should not be involved in personal habits.
Prohibition is imposed and maintained not because it is possible to reform the habits of human beings through the application of state coercion, but rather because by pursuing this unobtainable objective, fortunes can be made and officially sanctioned corruption can flourish. This is something that was made abundantly clear, ironically enough, in the writings of Roy A. Haynes, who was the Prohibition Commissioner under the Harding administration in the 1920s. In November of 1925, Haynes, who was a singularly zealous personality who would have been entirely at home in the company of the Taliban, published a report in which he described the extent to which prominent citizens were battening onto bootleggers' bribes, writes Edward Baer in his book Prohibition, 13 Years That Changed America. In what Midwestern city, unidentified in the book, but most likely Cincinnati, Haynes reported that the mayor, the sheriff, the judge of the city court, a former prosecuting attorney, a detective sergeant, a justice of the peace, lawyers, deputy sheriffs, and cabaret staffs and singers were all involved, and proprietors of places where liquor was sold illegally were systematically protected by the police in cognizance of higher officials. A mayor of Atlanta was sentenced to 18 months for participating in a bootlegging ring. New Jersey was a stamping ground for bootleggers doing volume business in a case involving 100,000 gallons of impounded wine and property worth $2 million. That's what we would now call civil asset forfeiture. The wine growers, a prominent citizen, and the ex-governor of the state of California all testified in favor of the accused. On the West Coast, one bank president, 14 wholesalers, a lawyer, and a deputy collector of internal revenue aggregated 31 years in jail and $167,000 in fines in a case involving liquor worth $4 million. And bear in mind that those prices represented the dollar's value as of about 1925. In the face of evidence of this type, the federal government, Haynes insisted, is reaching big operators, the higher-ups, with ever-increasing success. Transpose that misplaced assuredness into contemporary terms, and you could be reading from any press release issued on practically any day of the week in any jurisdiction in this country with respect to the enforcement of laws against narcotics. It is the same song transposed into a slightly different key. At the time of his writing, as later statistics would show, liquor was America's biggest industry. Americans were consuming 200 million gallons of hard liquor, 684 million gallons of malt liquor, and 118 million gallons of wine a year, and the bootleggers' overall income amounted to $4 billion a year. Once again, the prohibition inflated revenues of the illicit narcotics industry make it perhaps the world's biggest today. Rather than expose and detail instances of corruption among politicians, the Justice Department, the police, and state judiciary all over America, Haynes preferred to lay the blame for his bureau's failures on a powerful international wet conspiracy. He quoted Lord Astor, who claimed in a speech in 1923 that people are working in England to misrepresent the attitude and actions of America. He attached great importance to a 1922 anti-prohibition Congress in Brussels, attended by politicians from Belgium, Canada, Spain, Finland, France, Britain, Denmark, Italy, Norway, Sweden, and Switzerland, which, he said, was plotting to undermine American institutions under the pretext of defending individual and commercial liberty. In America itself, Haynes continued, no fewer than 42 organizations had been set up to fight prohibition. The most powerful, the Association Against the Prohibition Amendment, got massive financial support from former liquor manufacturers and dealers' associations. It practically paralleled in organization method the Anti-Saloon League, Haynes contended. That is, it systematically backed wet congressional candidates with considerable success, in that Volstead himself would lose his seat as a result of their efforts. Mr. Volstead was the sponsor of the Volstead Act. That was the enabling act for the Prohibition Amendment. In the last resort, for all the occasional fascinating glimpses he gave of his real problems, Haynes' book never dared explore in depth the crucial problem at hand, that for all the infrequent incorruptibles, law enforcement officials' hands were tied and the Prohibition Bureau doomed because of a web of collusion, a tacit conspiracy to batten onto prohibition involving politicians, the judiciary, the banks, and the police, extending from Washington to every state of the Union, and even involving the Attorney General himself from 1921 to 1924. But perhaps Haynes, who knew all about the drinking habits and corrupt practices of the Harding administration, deliberately wrote his book tongue-in-cheek. He was, after all, a Doherty appointee. That's a reference to Harry Mackasia Doherty, the Attorney General under President Harding. And well aware of the latter's appalling reputation, though he did pay a somewhat ambiguous tribute to him in his book, there can be no doubt as to the attitude of the nation's chief law enforcement officer, Attorney General Daugherty, he wrote, to whose department is entrusted the task of prosecuting violators of prohibition laws. It was symptomatic of the hypocrisy of the prohibition era that in 1921, the American Bar Association decided to hold its annual meeting in Cincinnati, the very town where almost the entire police force was on George Remus's payroll, either as convoy guards or as salesmen on commission. George Remus was the scion of an influential German-American family, I should point out, who was a very well-connected and very influential attorney. He represented many people on both sides of the Prohibition Entente, both the criminal underworld and the political overworld. And he was also the wealthiest and most influential bootlegger during the 1920s. He was a tabloid celebrity. In an age before mass electronic media, he was known in most households in the United States because of his exploits. In Daugherty's presence, the American Bar Association solemnly declared that the people of the United States have undertaken to suppress the age-long evil of the liquor traffic, win for the gratification of their appetites, lawyers, bankers, merchants, manufacturers, and social leaders, both men and women, scoff at this law or any other law, they are aiding the cause of anarchy and promoting mob violence, robbery, and homicide. Bear continues, after hours, many of those attending the meeting were haunting the speakeasies they denounced. Every lawyer present must have been aware that the general was on the take, using Jess Smith as his bagman, not only to dispose of controversial cases, but to protect big bootleggers and even peddle permits to them. But even the most cynical among them must have listened to Daugherty's keynote address with wry amusement. I do not mean to impute moral turpitude to him who is opposed to the 18th Amendment, Daugherty conceded magnanimously. But when the public sentiment is crystallized into law, there can be no question as to the duty of good citizens. They may still debate as to the wisdom of the law, but there is only one course of conduct, and that is obedience to the law while it exists. To refuse or to neglect to enforce a valid enactment of the legislative department of government, or to enforce it mechanically or half-heartedly, or to wink at its violation is without justification on any sound theory of government. Those who ask or expect this not only contribute to lawlessness, but destroy the basis upon which their own security rests. Our safety and happiness lies in obedience to law by every man, woman, and child. At the end of this oration, Bear notes, there was loud, prolonged applause by men who would go to the speakeasy and drink themselves into a stupor at night and then the next day prosecute the people who were serving that industry. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I'll be back again with you in a week. And until then, as always, dum spiro pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night. God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.
Can we cross?